This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, the Federal Court of Appeals in Atlanta has shut down timber sales in national forests in Georgia. The ruling will probably stop logging in the Southeast and have an impact all over the country. A scientist is measuring the effect of fishing techniques on cod in the Atlantic Ocean. If more of the fish that are put back can survive, the species may do better. We remember Nobel laureate and environmentalist Henry Kendall. Listeners comment on casinos, populations, sustainable development, snowmobiles, and ATVs. And on the Earth calendar, lettuce is being picked in Arizona. It's part of a great American harvest. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. A recent decision of the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, located in Georgia, has hit the U.S. Forest Service like a bombshell. The court ruled that seven timber sales that were supposed to go forward had to be stopped because the Forest Service did not follow its own rules when it planned the sales. In addition, the effect of the ruling may be to shut down all planned timber sales from national forests in the Southeast, from Virginia to Florida to Texas. The court's decision raises issues which might be used to invalidate planned sales all over the country. The original lawsuit was brought by the Sierra Club and five other environmental groups. Renee Voss, Sierra Club spokesman, explains that part of their challenge arose from the fact that the Forest Service regulations and the forest management plans for the Chattahoochee and Oconee National Forests required the service to survey plants and animals in the area to be logged, so it could be determined whether the cut would have unacceptable impacts. Apparently, the service did not conduct the surveys in any of the timber sale areas.
And the court said that until they have those surveys, they really should not be out there logging, destroying the habitat for these species, for which they don't have any idea how many numbers there are. They simply said that there had to be surveys when the Forest Service had no data whatsoever on 35 of the 37 species on the forest. Having no data is certainly not good enough to be able to say that they are maintaining the viability or protecting biodiversity on the forest.
Species found in the area which will now have to be surveyed include a type of large-eared bat, brook trout, yellow lady slippers, pileated woodpeckers, black bears, and the northern pine snake, to name a few. Buzz Williams is executive director of the Chattooga River Watershed Association, an environmental group trying to protect the national forests which were affected by the court decision. He says usually the Forest Service will acknowledge that a particular species exists in an area.
But just because we're doing this in this one small place, there are plenty of other places where they might exist, so this activity will not contribute to the decline. But that's based on speculation. It's very subjective, and they have not done the actual inventories of the whole landscape to see what these trends are with these threatened, endangered, and sensitive species. So what the 11th Circuit has said is that, yes, you have to do the work before you can make these decisions, and it's a landmark decision because the 11th Circuit traditionally has not ruled very well in these cases.
How long it will take the Forest Service to do the required surveys, and whether the planned sales could take place once there is enough information to estimate what effect the sales will have on plants and animals, is not clear. The Forest Service refused to comment or even provide a reaction to the decision. They referred us to the Justice Department, which defended the Forest Service in the lawsuit. A spokesperson for the Justice Department said they were studying the decision and referred all further questions to the Forest Service. Sierra Club spokesman Voss says similar flaws in the Forest Service timber sale planning process are being exposed in federal courts in other parts of the country. Challenges to timber sales have been filed in the Northwest, where plans were rewritten to require wildlife surveys as part of the aftermath of the spotted owl controversies. It is alleged that, as in the Southeast, surveys were never conducted. But Renee Voss says there is action in addition to litigation.
But recently there was something outside of the courts which was quite astonishing. The USDA's Office of Inspector General published a report which also included this issue, and they said that the Forest Service needs to gather surveys on these sensitive or threatened or endangered species and had not done so, and they found discrepancies in a number of areas in sampled districts around the country. So even the federal government itself is realizing the Forest Service is not following their own procedures.
Buzz Williams of the Chattooga River Watershed Coalition is not sure how much impact the 11th Circuit decision will have in the long run because of the Forest Service attitude which he says prevails in the southeastern region, an attitude which puts a premium on getting out the cut and meeting timber sale goals. But he says once the required data is collected, changes will be required in the management plans.
For example, old growth and roadless areas are very critical for the habitat requirements for a lot of these species, and there's just not much of it left. So in the new forest plans, they're going to have to be provisions for restoring a lot of this old growth in between these little islands of habitat that we have remaining so that these ecosystems function. So that's how this data is going to transfer into helping us craft these new forest plans. Currently, we don't know much about what's out there. Once we do, we have more knowledge to work with.
While the courts are stopping timber sales because the Forest Service does not comply with its own rules, Mike Dombach, who was appointed chief of the Forest Service about a year ago, is struggling to broaden the agency so our national forests are truly managed for multiple use, not just timber production. That means recreation, protection of streams for their value as fish habitat, and wilderness value should be receiving more attention. Renee Voss does not hold Dombach responsible for the improper sales in the Southeast, but he says they illustrate the problems Dombach is encountering within his own agency. The implications of the 11th Circuit decision for the rest of the country are still being assessed. Williams says it has come at a critical time for the Chattooga watershed, where sprawl from Atlanta is approaching like a freight train. He says finding out what is in the forest is the key to managing it sustainably. The prevailing opinion now is that all timber sales on national forests in the Southeast will be halted for at least a year. What comes to mind when you think of Cape Cod? Sandy beaches, swimming, boating, or maybe seafood? For more than 300 years, a 100-mile shallow stretch of coastline called George's Bank off Cape Cod has provided humans with some of the most productive fishing in the world. In fact, Cape Cod was named after the seemingly limitless number of cod that resided in the North Atlantic waters. However, things have changed dramatically. Overfishing and other forces have depleted cod populations to a fraction of what they once were. Today, it may take a cod fisherman a week to catch what he used to land in a day. But as Stephen Westcott reports, efforts are underway to help this troubled species.
At the New England Aquarium, children press their noses against the glass, full of wonder and awe at the variety of marine life in the tanks. It's a popular place to visit in Boston, but few people realize that a lot of research is conducted here as well. Some of the research occurring in recent years involves helping young or juvenile cod to survive the fishing process. Usually, cod are caught in drift nets or trawls, or by long lines.
Long lining is probably the closest thing to old-fashioned kind of fishing, and it actually was the very, very first type of fishing that you had in the Northeast. What you have to picture is at the beginning of that long line, there's a buoy. A little bit further down, there's an anchor. And then from the anchor, onto a certain amount of line. There are hooks that are placed off it so that you have maybe 18 inches or 3 feet of line that have a hook on the end of it. Those are baited. Sometimes the baited area of the long line can be a mile, it can be 2 miles, depending on what type of boat that's going out.
That's Dr. Mary Ann Farrington, research scientist at the New England Aquarium. Experts estimate that close to 20% of cod fishermen may be using long lines. During the process, juvenile cod become hooked when they take the bait. When the line is brought to the boat, juveniles are taken off the hooks and tossed back into the water. They are too young to keep and are considered bycatch, which is anything the fishermen cannot keep. Dr. Farrington says hooks oftentimes penetrate one or both jaws of juvenile cod.
There are many different ways of taking the fish off the hook, and some people take their time and take the fish off the hook gently. Other people, other fishermen use devices to take the hook off, mechanical devices to take the hook off, and it's an obvious thing, but the more severe the wound, the less chance that the fish has to survive. And what I looked at was, what's the physiology of the animal as it's going through the process? Is there anything that I can pick up from the physiology of the animal to help it survive?
Dr. Farrington has joined fishermen on their trips and finds the manner in which juvenile cod are taken off the hooks is important. Those that suffer significant wounds can lose more blood and other critical elements, such as glucose. The findings of Dr. Farrington are so new, they have yet to be published.
One of the ions were completely out of whack, and that could have ramifications in how well the fish swims, how well maybe he's even able to have synapses in his brain working, so that whether he could even, you know, identify a predator and swim away. And but they're very, very important in nerve transmission, and they're also very important in contraction. And so one of the ions was completely draining, so to speak, out of the fish. So to me, that said that one of the major reasons was because the animal was bleeding to death.
Dr. Farrington and her colleagues conduct experiments that simulate the process a juvenile cod experiences when hooked and released. The fish is hauled to the boat, then put in a cage, which is dropped back into the water and lowered. Besides wounds from hooks, the overall experience of being dragged to the surface can have severe effects on young cod.
There's a lot of different things that a fish goes through when it's being hauled up and down within the water column itself. One of the things that changes is the pressure on that animal. So, of course, you're going to be affecting things like swim bladders. The other thing that you have to be careful of is temperature changes. There's going to be a sharp thermocline at some point in the water. It's higher at certain times of year than others, but that thermocline is there. So you're going to go from cold water to relatively warm water. So that's going to affect how much stress the animal is going through.
Dr. Farrington estimates that as much as 50% of young cod that are hooked and tossed back die as a result of various physiological effects. This means that potentially a lot of young cod are not surviving to reproduce. Dr. Farrington says some of her colleagues are researching bigger hook designs that will deter juveniles from being caught and at the same time not dramatically reduce the hauls of fishermen. Besides research being conducted by scientists like Dr. Farrington, new regulations have been adopted to help cod populations. Dr. Andrew Rosenberg is deputy director of the National Marine Fisheries Service. He formerly served as Northeast Regional Director for the service. He says tougher restrictions have closed about one-third of Georgia's Bank to cod fishing. Besides Georgia's Bank, the Gulf of Maine contains the other significant population of cod in New England. Populations there, though, are even smaller than Georgia's Bank. To help increase those numbers, the New England Fishery Management Council recently issued tougher restrictions. Again, Dr. Rosenberg.
And if you're working and agree to work only on the Georges Bank stock, you do not have any trip limit. But if you're working on the Gulf of Maine stock, as of May of this year, you will have a trip limit likely to be of the order of 200 pounds. Last year, we started in May of the year. The fishing year begins in May. With a trip limit of 700 pounds, and that was reduced within a month down to 400 pounds because the catch was just coming in too quickly. The problem is we really need to stay off of fishing cod in the Gulf of Maine.
Some believe tougher limits is the answer to solving the problem of overfishing. But Dr. Rosenberg says it isn't that simple. He says agencies like the National Marine Fisheries Service have the difficult responsibility of balancing conservation with industry. Environmentalists complain about the environmental impacts of declining cod populations, while fishermen and women say tougher restrictions will destroy their livelihoods. Without fishing regulations, though, there will be no cod left for future generations, like the children visiting the New England Aquarium. For the Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Most of them are like, some of them are like really messed up. Some of them don't have eyes.
The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. A lot of listeners have been writing to us. Why don't you join them? 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Email green@wamc.org. The environment lost a friend and advocate in February with the death of Henry Kendall, who died while scuba diving in Florida. Kendall won the Nobel Prize in 1990 as a physicist for his research which led to the discovery and observation of subatomic particles. He was a founder of the Union of Concerned Scientists, a nonprofit group located in Cambridge, Mass. UCS Executive Director Bud Reese reflects on Kendall's achievements.
He was a real visionary. I think Henry's forte within the environmental movement was taking the long view. He never hesitated from taking on the big problems, encouraging the Union of Concerned Scientists to do that, and I think we'll sorely miss him as a result.
Kendall organized studies of nuclear risks associated with both power plants and President Reagan's plan to militarize space by putting nuclear weapons in standby orbit. Kendall was unusual because as a research scientist, he believed scientists should play a role outside of the laboratory. Again, Bud Reese.
I think Henry had a real vision that scientists have responsibility to get out in the public domain and can be very effective in the public debate, particularly if they're careful with the facts and, do it in a responsible kind of way. And I think ultimately his legacy will be to show to other scientists how that can be done responsibly and also how it can be done in a way that you can have an impact and not in any way jeopardize your career, but in fact, I think, enhance the credibility of scientists in the public eye.
We celebrate the life of Henry Kendall and his accomplishments in protecting the health of our planet. It's time now to hear what some of our listeners have been saying. Here's Stephen Westcott.
Listener Anna Chapman contacted us by email to say she is a loyal fan of the Environment Show and says she heard a report we aired about the environmental effects of casinos in southern Mississippi. She says she was concerned about our use of the word gaming in place of gambling. She says gaming sounds innocuous, just the image the gambling industry would like to promote. Anna says, quote, should responsible journalists so readily adopt the language of a special interest group, especially language that so obviously promotes an agenda? In news reports and features, shouldn't gambling always be called by its real name? End quote. We received a lot of feedback from a discussion we had a few weeks back about sustainable development. Leslie calls the amount of local development that is occurring in her area frightening.
Across the country, these people are making decisions to tear down woods and put up construction such as industrial sites or malls, and the public is not informed, or you know, can't protest because of legal and big ambiguities, and they have a lot of power, and people are unable to counter this. And community after community watches huge, ugly strip malls go up without their consent.
Tim Rogers emailed us to say he also enjoyed our discussion on sustainable development. He believes immigration is the greatest threat to the United States. He says, quote, we are taking in 3 to 4 million people each year. All of our efforts to help the environment will be useless unless we cut the number of legal immigrants to 200,000 a year, the same number of people that leave the country each year, end quote. Regarding the discussion on sustainable development, a listener by the name of Martha called in to say,
I was listening to the show tonight, and I was so glad that you had Paul Ehrlich on addressing the population problem. I think it's, you know, the biggest problem we have. And, you know, right around here, I'm just overwhelmed by all the tremendous increase of the SUVs and the suburban sprawl. It seems like our countryside is going to disappear in no time. And what really gets me, too, are these motorized morons that are always going around in snowmobiles and off-the-road vehicles, wasting gas and running over the flora and fauna.
We appreciate all comments, questions, suggestions, and story ideas. Call our comment line by dialing 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Hello, operator.
And now the Earth Calendar. As we speak, iceberg lettuce is being picked in Arizona. It's part of the Great American Harvest. Rick Rademacher is area manager for a major vegetable grower in Yuma. That's located in the southwestern corner of Arizona. Broccoli, cauliflower, spinach, parsley, and 10 different kinds of lettuce are grown on the 6,000-acre farm. But Rick says iceberg lettuce is the biggest crop. He says workers harvest the heads of lettuce by hand when it is mature after 2 to 3 months of growing.
The people go through the field and look for and select through sight and feel a head that is the right size, the right color, that there's no physical defects, and they cut it and trim it and inspect it as they go. And in some cases, we put it in a little plastic bag that you've seen in the stores, and then that's closed up, and then people pack it in the boxes, and boxes are sealed and stacked palletized on the truck and then hauled to the cooler.
Most of the lettuce produced on this farm is marketed to the East Coast, with some going to England and the Pacific Rim. The growing process begins during the summer months when the field is worked and irrigated. Rick says planting begins in September.
And we plant according to a sequence that enables us to harvest the same amount of lettuce for 5 months during the winter. So we'll be planting from September through December, so that we can harvest from November to April.
The farm is located near the Colorado River, which supplies water for irrigation. Fertilizers, herbicides, and pesticides are used in the growing process. But Rick says irrigation is the key to the whole production.
Well, it takes a lot of care and a pretty intense management scheme. It's not easy. We kind of defy nature on a grand scale when we start the crop, because we're germinating lettuce in temperatures up to 118 degrees. In September. Lettuce really doesn't like to germinate over 85 degrees, but through seed treatments and sprinkler management, we can get it done. And it's just a crop that you have to watch very, very carefully, and the crop will tell you what it wants, and you have to be able to listen to it and do what it needs.
Rick says weather also plays a role in the quality of an iceberg lettuce crop. If the temperatures are too hot, the lettuce becomes oversized and puffy. If it's too cold, the heads will be small and possibly suffer frost damage. At the grocery store, Rick says consumers should look for heads with a good green color and texture. And experts say the darker leaves are the most nutritious part of the vegetable. I'm waiting for the day when they will genetically engineer lettuce so that the dressing flavors will be grown right in the plant. Sounds like a neat idea. But getting bees to cooperate for honey mustard may be a problem. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, great plants to eat grow in the park. We meet a man who instructs others about the gastronomic joys that grow under the urban foot. The only trouble is he sometimes gets arrested. We talk green about livestock slaughter. There are laws designed to make it humane, but one critic says the rules are ignored. Author Myron Arms takes us into the liquid wilderness of the North Atlantic on a fresh wind. He reflects on the human enterprise and how distance from land puts it in a different perspective. Stay with us. Imagine yourself walking in the park with a friend. Your friend asks whether you are hungry and if you would like a bite to eat, his treat. He then starts picking wild plants along the trail and takes leaves from bushes and shrubs and offers them as a delicious salad. You might think it odd, but if you're friends with wild man Steve Brill, it could be a common occurrence. For years, Brill has been showing New York City residents how to find tasty snacks. He does that in all parts of the city. Stephen Westcott recently spoke to this unique forager to get to the root of the matter.
Steve Brill says his fascination with wild edible plants stems from his childhood, and by the late 1970s, he was studying plants on his own.
One day I was riding my bicycle for exercise near a park in Queens, in New York City, where I live, and there were some ethnic Greek women picking something. It turned out they were collecting grape leaves. I stopped and asked them what they were doing. Couldn't understand a word of it. It was all Greek to me. But I came home with the grape leaves, stuffed them, and made a very delicious recipe.
Brill continued to educate himself, and by the early 1980s, he was giving tours of parks and other natural areas to those interested in learning about wild edible plants. His tours grew in number and size, and with a budding new career, he adopted the name Wild Man. But Brill soon found himself out on a limb. In 1986, two New York City park rangers signed up for one of his tours.
It was a man and a woman. They said they were married. They never held hands or kissed, so I figured they'd been married for a long time. They paid me with marked bills in a park that was rampant with drug dealers, murderers, and muggers.
The couple photographed the wild man holding his adored munchables, and at the end of the tour, he illustrated how a common dandelion is indeed edible. The wild man was arrested and charged with criminal mischief for his grazing on public property. They searched him, but soon discovered Brill had swallowed the evidence. The arrest gained national media attention.
And subsequently, the New York City Parks Commissioner, who had sent the undercover agents after me, Henry Stern, negotiated with me, dropped the charges, and hired me to lead the same tours I was leading when I was arrested. And when we shook hands, we got on all of the local and national media for a third time. I worked as a New York City Parks naturalist from 1986 to 1990.
Besides giving tours, wild man Steve Brill gives lectures at camps and libraries and has authored a book titled Identifying and Harvesting Edible and Medicinal Plants in Wild and Not-So-Wild Places. He claims to be New York City's only full-time naturalist, giving some 80 public tours and lectures around the New York City area from spring to fall. I asked him what he likes best about his line of work.
Well, there's always a free lunch.
When picking wild plants, Brill says it's critical to know what to look for.
There are some very, very poisonous plants, but those could be useful too. You never know when the boss is going to come over for dinner. But you should never eat anything that you have not identified with 100% certainty.
On a more serious note, the wild man recommends people begin slowly when picking wild plants.
You want to start with a small number of very easily identifiable plants that have no poisonous lookalikes. Learn them really well. Follow them through the seasons because they change very greatly as the months go by. And start with small amounts the first time. Even if it is completely edible for everyone else, you may have an adverse reaction to it. That can happen with something as simple as a strawberry.
Besides dandelions, Steve enjoys other wild plants, such as Japanese knotweed, which he says is great in soups, and vegetarian ice cream. He also picks the common cattail, you know, those unique things you often see sticking out of marshy areas. The wild man says the inner stem tastes like cucumber or zucchini, but jokingly advises to refrain from picking them when animal rights advocates are present. While he maintains a sense of humor, there is a serious side to Brill's mission. He says the reason many Americans cannot identify an edible plant from one that is poisonous is because humans have become so disconnected from the natural world.
So it is the common species that people are continually trying to destroy when they grow in their yards, and we have an entire lawn care and chemical industry devoted to this purpose. I would rather eat some of these plants, appreciate them, let them grow, and not pollute these areas with herbicides.
In addition to being healthy food sources, Steve says wild edible plants are renewable and are not grown with pesticides that are not only bad for us, but can pollute entire ecosystems. For more information on the wild man's tours of New York City's natural areas, contact him through your personal computer. His email address is wildmansteve@bigfoot.com. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Eat your greens. Don't forget your beans. And celery. Don't forget to
We're Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're talking about animal slaughter, which is a difficult subject, and one of the questions is whether animals and cows and pigs and other creatures that are slaughtered for food are treated humanely and in accordance with the Humane Slaughter Act when they are taken to market. And we are going to be talking with a couple of people who know a lot about this. This is a discussion which may be graphic and may be uncomfortable for some, but it does have to do with a key element of our food supply, so it is important to all of us. Gail Eisnitz is with us. She wrote a book called Slaughterhouse, The Shocking Story of Greed, Neglect, and Inhumane Treatment Inside the U.S. Meat Industry. And she is also an investigator for the Humane Farming Association. She gives at times some wild details about what goes on inside a slaughterhouse. Talked to a lot of people who work in those institutions. Also with us is Steve Copperud, and he is president of the Animal Industry Foundation. It's an organization that represents meat producers and the livestock industry, and he also is senior vice president of the American Feed Industry Association. He's in Washington. So we're talking about meat processing and slaughter, and to get into this, Steve, why don't you take us through the process by which an animal walks into a slaughterhouse at one end and comes out a dressed carcass at the other?
Well, let me simplify it for you. There are some fairly complex portions of it, but basically you've got the delivery of the animals by truck. They are inspected and sorted and then moved through. They are stunned. They are then bled out or killed, skinned, eviscerated, and will then be further cut into meat portions, all of which is done in a federally inspected plant under the eye of several inspectors who watch for adherence and compliance with federal meat inspection laws as well as the Federal Humane Slaughter Act.
And Gail, you were in and talked to a lot of folk in slaughterhouses. Your findings seem to think that it didn't work that smoothly.
Right. Unfortunately, we wish it did. I spoke with individuals who represented more than 2 million hours on the kill floor. I spoke with many, many federal meat inspectors, the individuals who are required to enforce both the Federal Meat Inspection Act and the Humane Slaughter Act. And they all went on record, well, the workers went on record saying that due to dramatically increased production line speeds in the last 15 years, that they're required to do all sorts of horrendous things to animals in order to keep that line running smoothly. And the meat inspectors themselves explained to me that they're virtually powerless to stop the line when they observe violations.
Now that's interesting because they have explicit authority and are specifically ordered that if they see violations of either humane slaughter or the Federal Meat Inspection Act, that they are to shut those lines down and take appropriate action.
Now, Gail, you're saying that wasn't happening?
Right. That's not happening
at
all.
Well, before we get into the discussion of the law, when you say all sorts of horrendous things happening, for somebody who hasn't thought about this before, what are they telling you?
Well, I mean, it starts with transport. A lot of times, frequently, animals, particularly hogs, arrive at packing plants in the winter literally frozen solid, like rocks, and oftentimes they are still alive, and some oftentimes have to be pried from the truck walls. Some of them are still fully conscious. In the summer, thousands upon thousands suffocate from the heat. Once inside the plant, though, animals are just beaten and dragged with cables and chains. Some animals, particularly hogs, had meat hooks jabbed into their anuses and into their mouths to pull them when they had gone down and they were still fully conscious. That was a routine practice at some of the plants I visited. Animals are beaten to death, particularly crippled animals are. They're not properly stunned. That's a huge problem. And they go through, cattle go through the skinning process fully conscious to the point where they have their legs removed and their tails removed and their ears and horns. They have their throats cut. They're partially skinned. That's documented, fully documented, even by the USDA. And hogs, which aren't skinned, are dragged through what's called a scalding tank to loosen the bristles on their skin, and commonly they're dragged through the scalding tank kicking and squealing alive.
Now, before we get through every animal in the repertoire, tell me something, and I'd like both of your comments on this. There is this statute called the Humane Slaughter Act. Steve, what does that provide?
That provides that the animal, unless it is in kosher slaughter, that the animal must be unconscious when it is killed. The descriptions that Gail just gave, let's understand something, that the Humane Farming Association is an animal rights group, and an animal rights group has a certain agenda, and that is to put people off the consumption of meat, milk, and eggs, which certainly that description would do. You know, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that we have a totally perfect A100 system, but we have the best on the planet. And you know, to the degree that something might happen that is outside the realm of the law, two things should kick in. One,
the understanding that it is an anomaly, it is not routine practice as she describes it. And secondly, that if those inspectors, if those workers were seeing those things happen, then they had a legal obligation to report the plant.
Was it your view, Gail, that the inspectors simply weren't doing their job?
Well, one of the problems is that they're not stationed in the areas of the plants where the animals are being slaughtered. It's kind of hard to stop the line when you observe violations when you can't see violations.
Well, Gail, if they're not there, how are they reporting these infractions to you?
Well, I mean,
What are they seeing?
I certainly have several records of inspectors who stop, who pass by on their way in and out of the plant and all sorts of things. But I'd like to respond to what...
Wait a second. If they pass by, they saw these things, and they're not reporting them, but yet you say they're still doing their jobs. I'm not following that at all.
Steve, yeah, I mean, I do have reports from inspectors as recently as 1999 who observed these violations and did not even know, this is in USDA documentation, that they were allowed to write these plants up or stop the lines. I would like to say that even the USDA...
Then we've got a problem with USDA training then. And
we certainly do. We certainly do. In fact, I was on national TV this week with the Secretary of Agriculture, Dan Glickman, who went on record admitting that the Humane Slaughter Act is not a priority and the USDA does not have the resources to enforce it.
Let's go back into the plant for a minute. Gail, you mentioned, and I think both of you mentioned, the stunning issue. For folk that don't know what stunning is, Steve, what is it? And then, Gail, what is the problem?
We have cattle and hogs. There's a mechanism is a head bolt stunner. And what that does is it delivers a stun blow to the forehead of the animal with sufficient force to render it unconscious before it's killed.
That's for cattle, but for hogs, electricity is used to render the animal...
In some plants, yes, electricity will be used.
Okay, so...
99% of the plants.
Gail, your sense is, in your book, you talk about the stunning process as being one that isn't appropriate or not well carried out. What is the situation there?
Yeah, well, the situation is that when you have one individual required to stun 1,100 animals per hour, that's 1,100 hogs per hour, that's one animal every 3 seconds, and the stunning equipment isn't adequately maintained, you have problems. In fact, the USDA itself commissioned a study by the leading expert on humane slaughter, Dr. Temple Grandin, and she determined from her announced visits to 11 cattle plants that 7 out of the 11 plants she visited had unacceptable stunning. Now, that is not an animal rights group making a claim.
Just so, again, we understand the significance, what I hear you saying, Gail, is that if they're not properly stunned, then they are not unconscious, and so go through the process while still alive or still functioning.
Right.
Well, no, they're killed. You know, what happens, the arteries are cut, they're bled out, they die. But, you know, referring to the Temple Grandin audit, There were deficiencies that were found in some of those plants, and Temple reported and directed those plants. And where deficiencies were found, deficiencies are addressed.
Right.
And some of it has to do with training. Some of it has to do with downtime in the plants. But to paint the entire industry with a brush from 7 plants on a subjective audit is not necessarily, I think, a fair way to approach it. You also have to remember, though, that what Dr. Grandin was using was her own criteria, not that of the Humane Slaughter Act.
Well, let's go back for a minute. First, if the Humane Slaughter Act, does it provide specifically how this is to be done or what the result is to be?
Well, it's quite specific. It requires that voltages be appropriate for the animals that are being stunned, or that the amount of air pressure be appropriate for cattle that are being stunned with captive bolt guns.
And the right amount being one that will render them unconscious.
Right. It requires that an animal...
Okay. Now let's talk about where we go from here. If this is a problem, as you document that it is, Gail, what should be done about it?
Well,
and I'm talking about enforcement of the Humane Slaughter Act or rewriting it or whatever. How do you solve this problem?
Well, I mean, we have approached the Secretary of Agriculture encouraging him to place inspectors in their areas of the plants where the animals are actually being killed and giving those inspectors the authority to stop the line as is required by the law. Oftentimes, the inspectors aren't able to stop the line because they come under pressure from their supervisors.
Okay, Steve, how do you react to that? Put the inspectors in the place and have them shut down the line.
Peter, there's explicit authority to those inspectors to be able to stop a line, to be able to shut a plant down. The Department of Agriculture has explicit authority to be able to withhold inspection authority, which effectively stops that plant from operation if there are consistent and severe violations of humane slaughter or the Federal Meat Inspection Act. It's strange that, you know, we're trying to paint a picture of an impotent USDA when, in fact, you know, USDA has more than adequate authority and uses that authority at will. There is no lack of enforcement action by USDA.
Do plants ever do get shut down as a result of violation of the Humane Slaughter Act?
It's very rare. I did get some reports this year, and I was able to get the information about those plants under the Freedom of Information Act. And the plants that were shut down, it's quite humorous, actually. One plant was actually shut down for sanitation violations, but they were having problems with their stunning apparatus. When that plant was allowed to start up again after a consent decree had been signed, about a month and a half after it started up again, an inspector stumbled back to the area of the plant where the animals were being stunned and found that they weren't being adequately stunned. And when he asked questions of the worker who was doing the stunning, the worker explained to him that they had been having problems with the stunning equipment for the last month and a half.
Then the inspector should have at that point gone to the plant supervisor and shut the plant down if he felt the infractions were serious enough.
Steve, one of the things that I was interested in is Gail raises the question as to whether the inspectors are actually in the right places in the plant. Is this a problem from your perspective?
You know, the placement of inspectors, the operation of inspectors, the responsibility of inspectors are all negotiated on a direct basis between the industry, USDA, and the inspectors' unions. So, this is not a small union we're talking about, and it's not a union that usually lays back if it feels that its workers are being abused or underutilized. So, consequently, this idea that somehow these workers are being intimidated flies in the face of reality. I can't answer whether every plant has an inspector in every stun area at, 24 hours a day if the plant is operating 24 hours a day. But certainly the responsibilities of the inspector in charge go to make sure that that plant is fully inspected from start to finish.
But even as the Secretary of Agriculture admitted in our television...
Where did he admit this, Gail? I've not heard about this.
Yeah, it was on C-SPAN this past week.
I haven't heard about it.
Okay, well, I think we're going to have to defer to C-SPAN. I want to thank you both. We've been discussing animal slaughter, a place that produces food for the American marketplace. I'm sure you may have some ideas of your own, so give us a call at 1-888-49-GREEN. My guests have been author Gail Eisnitz and Steve Copperud. Gail has written is from the Humane Farming Association, and Steve is from the Animal Industry Foundation. As I said earlier, give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can listen to The Environment Show anytime on your personal computer. Go to our website. It's www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. When you get there, click on Listen to The Environment Show. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Myron Arms, it's the Cape Cod coast, where you think of the pettiness of society when the land disappears. In this portrait of place, Arms reads from his book titled Riddle of the Ice, A Scientific Adventure into the Arctic.
After Mike has left the deck, I stand at the steering station trying to orient myself to the night. The full moon lights the sky in a diffused glow. A thin veil of fog obscures the horizon, so that there is no perception of distance, just a cottony film of silver light that envelops the boat. But there are hundreds of miles of open ocean ahead of us, with no weather to worry about, no coastal shipping lanes to cross. I know that with Amanda checking the radar from time to time below, all I need to do is steer. So I hunker down in the seat behind the wheel, listening to the sound of water trailing off the stern, thinking about where in the world we've come from, where we are trying to go. 12 hours earlier, as we sailed past Race Point at the end of Cape Cod, a strange thing happened. The same thing that always seems to happen when you leave the land in a little sailboat. As we skirted around the Cape, the beach was only half a mile away, and the details of hills and towers, buildings and roads, automobiles and clusters of people stood out in vivid relief. Then in a few more minutes, Brendan found the south wind again, and as she pulled away from the land, the details began to blur. At 2 miles off, there were no people any longer. At 3 miles, the roads and automobiles were gone. At 5 miles, the buildings and the beaches disappeared. At 7, there was only the gray-green silhouette of hills at the rim of the horizon, punctuated by the tops of towers. At 10, the last remnants of the North American continent dropped unceremoniously into the sea, and we were alone. There is an odd feeling that comes at such a moment. As the land disappears, you feel yourself growing less distinct, as if the mirror that you normally see yourself in has suddenly started returning a weaker reflection. You begin to think about scale, about how small the land is and how large the sea. You begin to think about the Earth as a water planet, with over 70% of its surface covered with this liquid wilderness and only 30% solid and dry enough for human habitation. You begin to think about all the petty strutting and preening that goes on back there, and about how quickly it disappears beneath the horizon. Inevitably, you also begin to think about how small and unimportant you must be, and perhaps how small and unimportant the entire human enterprise. Tonight you are a sailor, moving along with the forces of nature rather than against them. You are a minion of the wind, only partially in control of where you go, just as in a few more weeks you'll be a minion of the ice, forced to do its bidding rather than your own. Maybe this is another reason why you feel so small tonight and so disengaged from the commotion and noise that you've so recently been a part of ashore. Joseph Conrad once wrote, "The true peace of God begins at any spot 1,000 miles from the nearest land." You're not 1,000 miles from the land tonight. You're not even 100. But the feeling that Conrad was talking about must be the same as the feeling you have here. The feeling of being safely at sea with the land and all its confusions well astern. The feeling of sailing fast, listening to the odd nighttime chatter of seabirds, watching the moonlight illuminate the tops of waves, moving your body in time with the rhythms of the boat. The feeling of connecting.
That was author Myron Arms reading from his book titled Riddle of the Ice, A Scientific Adventure into the Arctic. It's published by Anchor Books. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Picking lettuce in Arizona is okay. Catching cod up New England is a bad idea if the fish you let go die anyway. And harvesting dandelions in the park might get you in trouble. Get a copy of the show before you gather another meal. call 1-800-323-9262 and order show number 479. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer. Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Graff is audio engineer. The Environment Show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for The Environment Show.